Who are you calling a nice girl?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Not So Nice Girl. I am your host and recovering nice girl, Natalie Volpicelli. And today, I know I call you guys my Not So Nice Girl family, but I am for real bringing you into the family because I have my dear cousin, Sarah Prasmark, on, and we will be talking a lot about her experience with being a, you know, quote unquote, nice girl and people pleasing and kind of her story surrounding that. We already kind of planned it and our family talks a lot. So we'll probably be making this a two-parter, starting off first about kind of Sarah's aha moment in understanding her people-pleasing tendencies. And then we will move on to, okay, we figured it out. Now what? What do we do? And what did she do? Again, this is just one example, but hopefully I'm really excited for you guys to all to hear it. And hopefully you guys can relate and resonate. So without further ado, Sarah, I would love for you to at least begin with kind of where are you? Where are you working? All basic background stuff. Besides the fact that we're family members.
Yes. And honestly, I do think that Poppy and Uncle Ben would be very proud of us right now. My name is Sarah. I am...
Just need pasta.
Yeah, exactly. I am 30 years old. I'm currently in Connecticut and commuting into Manhattan, where I am a television producer for a major news network. But I'm a commuter, so I live out in Connecticut right now.
Nice. So yeah, we have pretty high up important people in our family, and I'm going to brag about it all the time.
I wouldn't say that.
No, but I can still say it. So we're going to kind of go on from that. So obviously, you're in the entertainment industry, in the media industry. With that becomes a whole unique sort of expectations and hierarchies that just go along with dealing with a lot of people who are well-known, high up. And on top of that, you know, there's a lot of being a producer. There's a lot of, you know, superficial face to face things, but there's also just kind of the background and calling the shots. So I would love for you to kind of talk about in your experience with that, where you kind of were forced to learn how to stand up for yourself and advocate for yourself and the importance of that. And with that, I know you have kind of some additional background stories, so we can start at the beginning, maybe if that works.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have been in the industry now about 8 or 9 years, and it's been a roller coaster. I started at another major news network in the live control room. So I was really thrown into a lot of breaking news. It was 2014, I think it was 2014 or 2015. So it's the start of the presidential race. There's breaking news like every other minute. So I started there after interning at a lot of other major publications that had another, you know, big group of personalities. And I was having a lot of burnout, besides just breaking news burnout, just kind of workload burnout, trying to balance it all. I just kind of graduated from college and I thought that was like how it was supposed to be. You know, you want to be the person who volunteers for everything, that's super reliable, that is, can be counted on, that has the best level of decision making, that doesn't fuck anything up. But then I came to realize that none of that is possible to do all of that.
Well, especially in a breaking news industry, you feel like you have to keep up. I think that's so common.
There's a great line from Dwight Schrute from The Office, and it's one of the episodes with the fire drill. And he says that you need to let fear and adrenaline execute your decision making. And that is kind of like what I think. I'm not speaking for the media industry as a whole, but that is something that I took to heart. I was like, fear, yeah, adrenaline, let's do this. And, you know, there's a million things going on at once that you're just trying to make sense of it all. And while that was happening, I was going through a lot of stuff personally, like early, you know, back in 2015, that kind of snowballed and really came ahead, about a year and a half ago. And what really kind of sparked my realization that how I was working, my outlook on, my work ethic, my communication, my relationships in and out of the workplace, with my family, with my friends, with my, you know, dating life, was a really bad hangover. It was my mom's 60th birthday. Shout out to Aunt Liz. And I remember laying on the couch and I was so hungover and I was like, why do I do this to myself?
Anxiety is so real.
It is the worst thing in the world. It is the worst thing in the world. And I was like, why do I do this to myself? There are certain things that are out of my control, like a tsunami of breaking news events, you know, maybe some other factors. But I was choosing to get hungover like this, to drink like this, to party like this. And once I realized that I was doing one thing to myself, it kind of like opened this can of worms of what other things I was doing to myself that weren't benefiting me. And once I had that realization, it just took off. I realized that I was not communicating as well as I could about my workload at work. I wasn't asking questions that I felt I obviously needed to know the answer to, but I was too embarrassed to ask, when in reality, those questions would make me a better colleague, a better producer, a better journalist. I was doing things socially, you know, going to things I didn't want to do. And then my social battery would be completely cut. And so that was, I think, the moment that I was like, I need to change the way that I am acting and living. We were talking about like blacking out during interviews, and I think that answers your question. I'm not sure.
No, that's great. I mean, yeah, so obviously kind of part of what we want to talk about is that aha moment, that anxiety, and you really coming to that realization that something needed to change. Mm-hmm. You were following a lot of what we call nice girl behaviors.
Exactly.
That,
yeah,
is actually not a compliment, everyone. It just means you're a doormat. Yes. It just means you're letting life happen at you rather than being an active member in your own life. So
exactly.
I would love for you to kind of expand on, for you, one of the main changes that you chose to do. I don't know if you touched on this already, but with alcohol was kind of cutting that out. And I would love for you to kind of explain that thought process in why you felt that alcohol and cutting that out would be like the perfect first step to fixing all of these other behaviors.
Yeah. I truly, in that hangover, kept asking myself, why am I doing this? It was me who did this to myself. Nobody was like forcing these drinks down my throat, you know? I was putting myself in these situations where I would think like, oh yeah, like I could have one or two glasses of wine, but then it was never just one or two glasses of wine. And you get those rose colored glasses after that second glass of wine, then you'd have a third and a fourth. And, you know, I think that any of my loved ones and my family and friends, they'd probably listen to this and be like, oh no, like you were fine. Like you weren't, you know, a bad drunk or a bad drinker. But what I was doing was I found myself in this like revolving door and I was not growing. I was still making the same, I don't want to say shitty choices, but just like not productive choices, you know, like I was single at the time, living in New York City, and I'd go out on a first date, and like within, you know, an hour, I'd be like, this guy's great, he's super nice, but I don't think it's it. But then 2-3 drinks later, I'd be like, he's not that bad. It's like, and then I would find myself in this cycle of like, maybe I do like him, maybe I don't.
Beer goggles are real, people.
Yes.
It's real. Yes. It's been tested and researched. Uh-huh. It's very real.
It's so real. And so, you know, even not even just like that, or like hanging out with certain people where, you know, we weren't doing things that I enjoyed to do. I enjoy doing, or we were talking about people that I had no business talking about. I didn't know them. I didn't know, you know, context of the situation. I wasn't growing. And when I realized like what that factor was keeping me in that revolving door, it was drinking. You know, I wasn't advocating for myself. I wasn't listening to any intuition. And I'm not saying it was like a big intuition of that's a dangerous situation. It was a big intuition, or a little intuition of like, I actually want to go home. Like, I don't want to go out till 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And so I would ignore that because I had a few glasses of wine, and then it would completely ruin my next day, you know? And so it was like my time in that headspace was larger than the time I was clear-headed and I was sober and I was productive and I was practicing self-care.
Yeah, and I think that's so key and important with that, for all the listeners too, is especially those who are in your 20s or in your 30s, it's not black and white. It's not your drinking. So obviously you're an alcoholic. Like, and I think that that's
exactly
what we do a lot, is we don't want to stop drinking or we don't want to stop partying, because then we're admitting like, oh, we have a problem. We have a drinking problem.
Exactly.
And there's differences between alcoholism, which is a very real disease and has its own set of behaviors and actions, and just acknowledging that this behavior isn't serving me well.
Exactly. I like to say,
balance.
Exactly. I like to say, when, you know, when people ask me about it, that I don't have a drinking problem. I have a problem with who I was when I was drinking. And it's a huge distinction for me. And that coming to terms with that connotation really helped in my own recovery, because I felt that there was like taboo if I was going to meetings, if I was going to AA meetings, or I was going to my sober group meetings, or I was reaching out to my sober friends being like, hey, like I'm having some alcohol cravings, or I'm struggling in my sobriety right now. You know, I felt like almost I didn't deserve that level of resource and support. But when you take away the taboo of like, alcohol is a depressant, like it was banned, it was illegal for a reason in the prohibition. You know, it's a weird substance that messes with you, and you don't have to be a falling down drunk to have a problem with the way that you consume alcohol. And that's a big, coming to that thing, you know, being a people pleaser. I didn't want to say, yeah, I had a weird relationship with alcohol. Like nobody wants to be friends with that girl. Nobody wants to date that girl that can't, you know, party and hang out. And I could not have been more wrong.
In your industry and I think just, we touched on this, and I talk about this a lot with a lot of my friends. It's becoming a weird norm, especially in corporate America and in people in their 20s, where everything is surrounded by drinking.
That everything.
You want to meet with a friend? Okay, well, let's go grab a drink. First date?
Yes. Drink.
All of these things are surrounded by it. So you start to believe that I'm going to have no friends if I don't drink. And that's just that's not the case at all. At the end of the day, even, you know, that happy hour, you sitting there and getting an orange juice doesn't keep you from interacting and hanging out with your friends. And that's not to say, like, maybe sometimes you want that glass of wine, and it depends on the person, obviously. And for you, you chose to cut it out completely, which is so admirable. And for other people, it might just be, you know, I don't need to do this on a Tuesday.
Exactly.
Whereas you feel this weird pressure, especially living in a city that we have to. And I want to touch too, because we talk about the anxiety. So kind of the science on it, guys, is alcohol is a depressant. It depletes your frontal cortex of dopamine. And that when you wake up, your frontal cortex is in charge of decision making, problem solving. Your prefrontal cortex is everything. That's everything. And when you wake up from a hangover, part of what you're feeling and why you're euphoric is because you are, why you're anxious is because you're in a deficit now. You are trying so hard to replenish and your brain can't move that fast. That's not, it's not meant to move that fast. It's similar to if you were to stop eating. And your gut starts adjusting to a different amount of food and it will slow down and it will digest in a different manner. And so continuously doing that, you're training yourself to just behave in a different, your brain, your actual chemistry to behave in a different way. And that's why you get these anxiety emotions. It's not just... It's not just, oh, because I did something bad last night. It is genuinely neurotransmitters in your brain pushing these anxious, depressive symptoms. It's a very, very real thing. So, and it's that's like, not to it's say, a- I'm not going to sit here and say, don't ever drink to anyone. I'm never going to tell you guys. I just am saying it's like I even drink and I have to watch it because it's just, especially as I already have anxiety, there's a reason why you make worse decisions when you're drinking alcohol and why the next day you feel bad. Because
and what was funny was like, what was funny was my anxiety didn't come out about like bad, worse decisions. It was little things. It was the outfit I wore. It was the way I danced or this or that. And it was like, wait a second. That should not be what I'm thinking about. What I should be thinking about is what I'm going to do with my day, how I'm going to take care of myself. And as somebody who has depression and anxiety too, it was just, I was in the negatives of all of my chemicals.
You're already starting. You're already starting at a deficit. Yes. And now you're just like, let's keep it going.
And then I would be so hard on myself. Because there's this romantic idea about drinking that I searched for and could not find. And, you know, there's something romantic about having a glass of wine with dinner and, you know, oysters and martinis, which I used to love and all this stuff. But it never actually met those expectations in my head. And then I would shit on myself thinking, well, what did I do wrong? Why didn't I have this like great magical day or this great magical night? And so I was literally my own worst enemy. I was working against myself. And what I had realized after my first few months of, you know, stopping drinking and going to, you know, my sober group, shout out to Sober Book Club and Retired Party Girl.
Oh gosh.
They're amazing. Was that I was dulling this intuition that that I have completely personalized since the day I was born. And I would, in the smallest things, like when my friends would say, where do you want to go to dinner? I wouldn't actually say where I would want to go to dinner because I was only thinking about the group context, the night, etc. When somebody would throw out a place and be like, I don't like anything there. I'm not going to eat anything there. I wouldn't say anything. And so I was working against myself in that irony of like, I'm supposed to be my own biggest champion and I want X, Y, Z for myself. And I was the one who was pushing myself farther and farther away from it.
And to clarify that a bit further. So in that sense, you were using alcohol kind of to allow yourself to draw those intuitions. I mean, in a way,
it's
kind of numbing these original thoughts that may make you want to stand up for yourself and make you want to say, I don't want to do that. I want to go home, things like that. But when you were drinking alcohol, you were able to feed into these people-pleasing behaviors that you so desperately wanted to continue.
Totally. I was like, I thought I had to live a certain type of life. I thought I had to have relationships with certain types of people in my life that like are, you know, kind of traditional, that people encourage, that society talks about. And I wanted a certain type of friendship, romantic relationship, et cetera. And I just was a little bit more, I guess, willing to go along with the bandwagon when I had a few drinks. When in reality, I realized that I didn't need or want that type of lifestyle, but I thought I should. Everybody else was doing it.
You lived in New York City too. So mm-hmm. like, I feel, again, it's that romanticizing romanticizing someone else's dreams and whose dreams that we don't know.
Exactly. And so like a great, like I would be like, no, I really just want to hang out at home and watch Bones and just like not do anything. But if I had a glass of wine, then I would just be a little bit more willing to go out and meet a bunch of people for more drinks or dinner, et cetera. And when I stopped drinking, I was like, actually, I'm a homebody. I really like Bones. I like all my TV shows. I don't want to actually do that. It's draining. I am a very, like, I have social anxiety. And so that wasn't helping either. And so, yeah, it was dulling a lot of intuitions, but also fueling the people pleasing. You know, like I said, there was a few like relationships in my life that I thought I had to bend myself completely out of shape to make this person happy, fully set myself on fire to keep this person warm. And alcohol just made it a little bit more bearable to be around that person, which like red flag.
Yeah.
You know, red flag. If you need alcohol to be around anyone, you need to look into that relationship a little bit. And
similar to if you feel like you need to have a shot before a first date, maybe just don't go on the first date. Maybe you just don't need to be dating right now.
Exactly. And so it was definitely dulling some intuition and fueling something that was not serving me at all.
And I want to kind of talk to with you about this. I think this piece about this expectation is really key. What I've noticed with myself, and I mean, a lot of people in our family, we love putting on this party girl extrovert mm-hmm. face. And not to say like I wasn't crazy loose party girl, but I was always putting on this optimistic, happy, sunny persona mm-hmm. and partying or going out and drinking and being the life of the party. And you're making everyone laugh and you're getting everyone on the dance floor. And that type of attitude just kind of matched on to this already nice girl. I have to always be sunny, always have a smile. If people aren't having a good time, I'm responsible for that. So I need to be doing all of this stuff to make sure everyone's having fun. I mean, to the point where like I would buy people drinks because I was like, have fun. I don't have money to spend on that. And I really had to talk to my mom about that, where she was like, you're trying to be a party girl because you're trying to force everyone else to have fun or to get this persona that you're the fun person to be around and it's hurting you. And
and I think like, you know, jumping off that a little bit with the extrovert party alcohol kind of environment, I found that in that situation, with our family, friends, etc., we were kind of joking and making light of some really fucked up things that had happened to us.
Yeah.
And I do believe that sometimes humor is a great, I don't want to say like treatment, but there is, you know, sometimes a laugh does help kind of bring out a good change in energy and perspective to the situation. But, you know, like somebody used to say about our family that we would put the fun in dysfunctional. And it wasn't until I like kind of dried out that I was like, that's not funny. You know, there is a part of a level of dysfunction that can be silly and can be goofy. But in these types of situations, I was making light of really fucked up things that had happened. And it wasn't until, I think it was my older sister was like, Sass, like, that's not funny. Like, are you okay? And other people weren't helping me. Like, I would make jokes about stuff out at drinks with friends and stuff, and they would laugh along with me. Sure, I probably made them feel insanely uncomfortable, but I didn't have any, like, agency on it. I didn't have any perspective of that, like, what had happened and what we were going through as a family wasn't funny. It was traumatic. And my senses were dulled in that, where I thought it could be a punchline. And it wasn't.
Yeah. It wasn't. And I think that's a very common coping mechanism that people use. And in so many ways, it's great. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, never joke about anything. Like, that's not rational. I think people want to find humor in things. However, there's a fine line between joking to minimize and joking to process. And if you are just minimizing what you're going through, I think this is a really common thing for people who have these disorders that like depression, anxiety, OCD, where a bipolar, where it's become a colloquial joke. And I talk about this a lot. So we joke because it's a social thing now. And we have it and we have very real experiences about it. And instead, we're joking about it.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that, like, listen, I'll find a meme about depression or OCD and I will fucking laugh my ass off. Like,
There's hilarious memes about sobriety. Yeah, everybody
are funny. It's great. So like, and that's my way of also saying like, oh, someone gets what I'm going through. Ha 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 ha. Let's laugh about it.
Exactly.
Because truthfully, there's only so much you can do about it.
Yeah.
So let's laugh a little. But then there's a difference between that and minimizing it by laughing and saying like, ha ha ha, yeah, that was crazy. Let's all just laugh about it.
Yeah, like using...
And to distract from the actual emotion, because I think that's part of, with a nice girl, we don't want to have bad emotions. So we replace it with humor.
Yeah.
Because that's an easier emotion for us to have.
And what I then kind of reflected on was that I was using my trauma or what had happened as a butt of a joke to make other people laugh, to make other people, you know, have a good time. But in reality, what I was doing was I was asking for help. And I was too much of a nice girl to just straight up ask for help because I didn't want to seem needy. I didn't want to seem as dramatic as the other people, you know, that were maybe needed help. So
it was a way of talking about it.
Exactly.
But in a quote-unquote socially acceptable way versus just actually sitting someone down and being like, I'm going through this shit and I need to talk about it. And for you, I mean, obviously I know what you're talking about, but for our listeners, if you don't mind, you know, even broadly talking about kind of what you were going through with specifically your poor family.
So I touched
on that a bit.
Yeah. So I, at the hangover that ended all hangovers, it was the end of a year where I had ended up almost 4-year relationship in a very abrupt way where I felt as though I had done everything right and it was still wasn't good enough. And it ended. I had moved to, from Atlanta to New York and I had worked my ass off at this station. All the time. I'll do it. In the pandemic, I was figuring out how to set up feeds from home and et cetera. And I had gotten laid off, which was not, you know, a reflection. Now I know a reflection on my work ethic. It was obviously a larger business decision.
But it's almost impossible to not personalize.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I had some relationships with family members like come to a head and go in completely different directions. I had one where we had had a tumultuous relationship and, you know, he had sought out his own help and we had grown as best friends. Then I had another relationship with someone where I was trying to fit this circle relationship into a square hole. And I was doing everything to make this person happy. I had put myself in social situations I didn't like. I was answering phone calls when I felt completely drained. I was, you know, adjusting plans that have been made for months and months and months and months to try to fit in, you know, make everybody happy. My parents are divorced like almost every other person in this, you know, day and age. And I was trying to manage. Yeah. I was trying to manage, you know, being a child of divorced parents, who gets this holiday, who gets that holiday with this weird thing and that weird thing, et cetera, et cetera. And I just was like, I'm not getting any return on my investments here. What is happening? You know, I felt like I had no tangible results. I wasn't growing as a person. I was still in, you know, toxic behaviors of being upset with myself. The relationships weren't changing. They weren't growing. They weren't serving me at all. And it wasn't until I found, and we had talked about this burger salad kind of analogy.
Yeah. This is amazing. I love it.
Yeah. So I, as you know, a child of the almond mom generation, I was at a restaurant and I look at the menu and I'm like, I really want this cheeseburger. I want a cheeseburger and a full sugar Diet Coke and a bunch of French fries. But I had convinced myself that I had had a bad quote unquote eating week and I needed a salad. So I begrudgingly ordered the salad and I'm eating it the entire time being like, I should have gotten the burger. Why didn't I get the burger? This doesn't even taste good. I should have gotten the burger. And I couldn't stop thinking about the burger for literally the rest of the day. And so now thinking about that, I was ignoring what my body needed. My body needed clearly protein, carbs, whatever else is in a burger and a soda and fries. And now I keep that with me in a lot of the decisions that I make, from anywhere between like, what do I want for lunch? To, do I really have the mental energy right now to answer this phone call from this person? Do I want to go to this social event? Do I want to watch the show that everybody else is watching so I can have something to talk about? Or do I just want to watch the same episodes of Dateline over and over and over again? And when you know it, everybody listening to this knows that feeling of, but I really want this, but I really want this. And so now I really tap into that and like, you know, everything from, like I said, answering messages, showing up to, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, family functions, how to act as a person. I even take it in the workplace. When a story, you know, they throw a story assignment out there, I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, I should volunteer for this because everybody likes an overeager beaver. But my intuition is like, am I the best person to tell this story? Am I passionate enough about the story that they're telling? Could somebody else tell this story better? And
that's the really good employee, because that's the one who delegating is there for a reason, because people have different strengths.
Exactly. Exactly. And so also in terms of, you know, maybe even some like tenseful moments with people, friends or colleagues, trust your intuition. Sometimes you have that intuition where it's like, I should say something here. I should say something. The right thing to do is to say something. But if your gut and your intuition is telling you I need a breather. I need to discuss this. I need to just like remove myself from the situation. Do it. And there's a way to do it respectfully. Like, you don't need to like light a match and drop it and like tell everybody to go fuck themselves and not see them for 2 weeks. There's a way to communicate, to be like, I hear you. And I think that this is worth discussing later, but I'm going to take a minute to kind of like debrief, gather my thoughts. There's a way to say what you mean and not say it meanly. And that is something that I have discovered that I did when I was drinking. I would say mean things. I would say the things I meant, and I would say them so meanly, and they weren't getting into the people's brains about how I was feeling. Because
because when you're drinking, you're not actually conveying what you want to. You're conveying it in this convoluted way, so it's coming off in not even, okay, one, you can say things in a nice way, but you probably weren't even saying what you really wanted to say. No. And I laugh all the time. I've just been thinking about that cheeseburger salad, because I'm sorry, if you can't relate to that, I don't know.
It is.
Honestly, if you can't relate to that, I'm so happy for you.
You're an amoeba or whatever those things are. And what is funny now is like, my little sister uses it. With my boyfriend, I'll be like, I'm burger salad right now. And he'll ask me, he'll be like, you know, what do you actually want? And I think that once you put out this energy with people of kind of explaining your thought process, explaining, I really want the burger, but I feel like I need to do the salad, and you explain that thought process, you will attract people who have similar, you know, mental ways of thinking about things.
Yeah. This is a total side note, but I mean, not really. It's funny. So like I have a history of anorexia, and when I was going through my refeeding, and when you go through refeeding, you kind of do go through a sense of binging, because your body's so malnourished that you crave so deeply. And I was finally allowing myself to eat, but I still had these no foods.
Mm-hmm.
It's so similar to you. And I was talking with my, obviously it's a bit more extreme, but like I was talking to my nutritionist, and I was like, I really wanted candy.
Yeah. But
I was so nervous, because I had been in a binging mood. Like, and I had been binging, that if I ate candy, I wouldn't be able to stop. I couldn't control myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I would freak out about that. So I would never eat the candy because I didn't want to binge. And then I'd choose something else. So I'd choose like fruit, or I'd choose something less scary.
Yeah.
But I would truthfully eat so much of it, that if I had just eaten one piece of chocolate, like calorically wise, my second option was so much more. And finally, my nutritionist was like, I'm sick of this for you, because you're not giving yourself what your body actually wants. And she said, I dare you. She was like, if I'm not right, we can fight about it later, but I dare you. Had these little Dove chocolates that had like these sayings in them too. And she said, when you want candy, eat just two Dove chocolates. She was like, they're even, you know, dark chocolate's good for you. Okay. But just eat that and tell me if you binge. And she was like, just after each, like, she was like, eat two to five. And she was like, just after each one, just sit and think, do you feel satisfied? And I think I ate like three or four, which is nothing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I feel great. I don't need a binge.
Yep.
And it's the same thing in life, where you're afraid if you stand up for yourself once, or you don't pick up that phone call or don't go to that social event, that it's going to spiral out of control, that it's going to be so much more of a big deal than it actually is. missing one social event or standing up for yourself one time doesn't mean no one's going to ever want to talk to you again. No one's going to ever invite you again, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Whatever it is that you're telling yourself, or passing up one work opportunity doesn't mean they're going to be like, oh, you're fired. We don't want
you. Exactly.
It's one thing, and we build it up to be so much bigger than it is.
It's all the what ifs.
This analogy, because it is just we've added so much meaning to something that didn't need it.
No, and it's like that feeling that's saying you want the cheeseburger, and sometimes you very honestly sometimes you want the salad.
Yeah,
but that feeling, that voice, is literally so perfectly tailored to you and your best interests, because it's like this little AI machine that has gathered information from, you know, what you've been through, how people have reacted to certain things, how you've reacted to certain things. It's really like your little guardian. And, you know, I always had that fear of if I didn't do what this person wanted, what if, what's going to be the reverb? Like the drama would be massive, and who's going to end up cleaning up that drama? It would have been me anyways. So what's a little tiny drama versus a fucking tidal wave of drama?
Yeah. And I also want to talk about too, kind of on, as we're talking about like drinking culture and social events and things, I would love to reiterate for all of my listeners the difference between an introvert and an extrovert. Because an introvert and an extrovert is only separated by the tool is, how do you recharge your battery?
Mm.
What plug do you use to recharge your battery? And it's just like an introvert uses like the European plug or like a USB, and the extrovert uses like an American or like a USB-C or whatever. That's the difference. It's not about what you're actually doing. Both introverts and extroverts could go out, party, whatever. It's just an introvert drains faster. And then to re-gas up, they need to be alone. They need to be
on. I never knew that.
It's a common misconception. And people, I think, especially with all of these, what is it called? All these personality tests, people.
Oh, the EM.
Yes. Yes. You know what I'm saying. People put so much merit on it, but in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And they choose their actions and they choose how they behave, and they take such pride in whether they're an introvert or an extrovert. And it's completely misconstrued, because you can be an outgoing introvert. You can really enjoy being with people, but you might just drain faster. You might be only be able to handle so much. And then you need to go home and you need to be alone. You need a bath. You need.
Yeah.
And there are other people that, I mean, kind of the way I explain it too is, if you've had a really bad day, do you need 30 minutes alone and to take a shower? Or do you need to go hang out with friends? Which one's going to make you feel better? And that also can change.
Yeah.
Day by day. So you're never going to be just one. But an intense introvert usually always says, I need 30 minutes alone. Mm-hmm. And an intense extrovert usually says, I'm only going to feel better if I'm with other people. They'll give me that energy back. And so I really wanted to stress that, because I think what we're saying with like people pleasing also is because people label us, because we're outgoing, oh, you're the extrovert, so you can take on this, you can take on that. You're so willing to talk to people. You're so willing to go out. You're so willing to do whatever it is. But to our core, that's not actually what we want.
Yeah.
And trying to determine and listen to what you internally need takes a lot of practice, but is so much more important. Because
exactly,
that's how you recharge your battery.
Exactly. And when you think about it, like the next time you are at an ice cream shop and you see all the flavors in front of you, there will be a voice in your head that's like, I want peaches and cream with pretzel toppings and whipped cream and a cherry and et cetera, and you know, everything. And then you'll hear your friend go, oh, I just want vanilla. And you're like, should I be having vanilla? And you're like, no, I want all of the fixins on this freaking ice cream. And it's so true. I had no idea that was the introvert extrovert thing.
That's my favorite thing to talk about because it angers me so much because I am the absolute, and I actually get extrovert on those personality tests. And part of it is because I fucking lie. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I'm literally a psych person. And I'm like, those things are literally so rigged. There's a reason why survey responses are not reliable because it's response bias. You do what they're, I talked about it with my friend when we were talking about the DSM questions.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty clear which one's which. They're not fooling anyone. They're really not. And you pick to what you think you're supposed to be. And for so long, because I was outgoing and because I was like ray of sunshine, I would be like, I'm an extrovert. I am.
Uh-huh.
And then I would totally shut off that side of me. That was like, I need my enclosure time.
Yes.
Not talk to me. Do not look at me. I can't even have light around me.
Have you seen that funny meme where it's like, sometimes people pack for the person that they should be on vacation? Where it's like they pack like 6 books, they pack an entire workout, you know, outfit, everything. And I would do that. I would do that. And then finally, when I saw this meme, I was like, I am that person. I have packed for workouts on every single vacation that I have gone on. And do you know, Natalie, how many workouts I've gone on a vacation?
I hope, honestly, zero. Fucking not. Because
zero.
I do the same thing.
Exactly. And for people who love that, that is so great for you. And I'm so happy that you can do that for yourself. But I have come to terms that I am not that chick. I am not that chick. And so now I've got extra room in my suitcase for all my things. I call them all my things. I have my Nod Pod and all my weird skincare and all my, you know, weird things. And once I just realized that, like, I guess I was packing my life suitcase as a person I should be who works out and reads books on vacation and who doesn't sleep till noon, it was very freeing.
Yeah, I mean, and thinking of that, like, I think about that as an analogy, that suitcase.
Yeah.
The amount of space you open up when you let go of the I should be, I am supposed to be, the amount of mental energy you get back to fill with things that matter.
Yeah.
Is astounding when you let go. I mean, anyone could sit there and say, I should be this, I should be that. I was just talking about it today with someone about like upward comparison, downward comparison will be the death of us because you could sit there and do that forever and ever and ever.
Forever.
But all you're doing is literally you're on a treadmill. You're just in the same place. You're not getting anywhere. You're just making yourself feel bad.
Yeah.
Like, and once you let go of that, now you have all this spare time in your brain to think about whatever the fuck you want. Mm-hmm. And also to just actually understand and sit with what do I want?
Yeah. And what you actually makes you happy.
Yeah.
You know?
And you're so busy comparing and you're so busy like, looking at, I was talking to, I forget who it was, but about, I think it was like on Call Her Daddy, actually. and they said, they were like, we are in the digital age and we have everything at our fingertips, everything. But every single, I have 18 billion locations. We weren't meant to have this much information. We weren't meant to compare this much. And we have some, and I adore research. I love it so much. But we also will misread data or something of like,
yeah,
most people are married by X. Most people have babies by X. Most people stay in their job for X. Okay, well, there's still multiple people who aren't and are still successful and happy. Like, that's what I think, like, when you actually take a step back, you could be fitting this perfect role. And you could be miserable.
And the other, like, I think misconception is, like, we also assume that those other people want the thing that we think that they want. Yeah. You know, like, when I was talking about stopping drinking, I was like, oh, like, how am I going to find someone who wants to date me? And, like, I have this baggage of that I don't drink. Like, you know, like, how are they ever supposed to bring me to a wedding? Or, like, what are they going to say, et cetera, et cetera. And that was that, I was my own worst enemy in that situation too, you know? Or, you know, I was recently talking to my boyfriend and I was like, my cravings for alcohol have kind of resurfaced in a way that's like, I want you to be able to have a girlfriend that shares a glass of wine. And he looked at me and he was like, why? Like, what is that going to, how is that going to change anything? And I was like, well, I don't know. Like, I guess I see couples like sharing wine on Instagram. And he was like, okay, like what, that means nothing to me. And I was psyching myself out, assuming that he wanted one thing when it couldn't have been farther from the truth.
You finally got comfortable with yourself not drinking, that you were like, let's stress about something else.
What is wrong with me?
No, that's everyone's doing.
Yeah, I see this all on Instagram. And in reality, this couple on Instagram probably got a screaming, yelling match right after they finished that bottle of wine. But we don't know that.
Yeah, they also could have drank like 8 bottles of wine and they both got way too drunk. And then one of them had to care for the other while they were throwing up. Like,
exactly.
Well, and that's the other thing too, is like, we love imposing our fears and projecting our anxieties on other people and jumping to these conclusions, when if we actually just talked and spoke to them, we didn't have to go through these 18 different hoops.
No.
We could have stopped at hoop one and been like, huh.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't need to stress out about the rest. Yeah. I didn't need to do 18 more what ifs, because I could have just shut that off if I actually asked, or if I actually just tried it. And I think we are so, so risk averse to the point of like, and I struggle with this myself, of trying to be so congruent. And this idea of cognitive dissonance, where what we think, what we believe, we are trying to align that with our behaviors. And we're so, I think, in this world of also like cancel culture, PC, everything, we're so afraid of messing up and saying and admitting, oops, that's not right. I didn't want that.
Yeah.
And so we are afraid to, you know, try out not drinking. See how we feel. Maybe we feel better. Maybe that wasn't the root cause. Maybe we still feel like shit. Okay. We'll figure out the root cause. We'll redirect. But we tried it. Didn't work. Or, you know, maybe we're so afraid about like whatever in dating. Okay, go on a date and try it. And we're so afraid of messing up or embarrassing ourselves or admitting we did something wrong, or, you know, we went left when we should have went right, that we don't even do it at all. So we're never going to find out that right was the, you know, that path was correct, because we didn't even try it. And I think that I loved, it was like going around, I don't know, Twitter or something, of like hashtag, like normalize changing your opinion. Normalize
1000%.
Normalize reading something, normalize experiencing something and being like, I was wrong.
Yes.
Literally yesterday, I have convinced myself, I don't know, because I thought it was like quirky or unique or whatever, probably all of the above. But I also like made it, when I was younger, I didn't like chocolate ice cream. I didn't like chocolate cake. I just didn't. And I preferred the vanilla, the caramels, all of that. I didn't like it. But it got to a point where like I would get like a Neapolitan and I'd like some of the chocolate and I'd be like, it's really good. But like I can't actually get more because I've already claimed that I
don't like chocolate.
And so I would never get it. And I made this big stink about it. Like two facts, two truths and a lie. My truth would always be that I didn't like it. Like I made it it's so stupid. I made it my personality. And last night I was eating Dolcezza dark chocolate truffle ice cream. Delicious. And I was literally like, why did I do that for so long? Like, literally, Sarah, I didn't like it once when I was 5. And I am now 26. So the past 21 years, the amount of years that I said that I just didn't like chocolate cake, could drink right now, legally.
Yeah.
Because one day I said it was. And that's kind of what we do is like, you think that if you say it once, that everyone's going to think, well, I thought that. And you're forgetting people don't give a shit about you that much. Like people aren't taking notes and keeping tabs that much. And they aren't keeping tabs where if you say, yeah, I changed my mind, they'll be like, that's fucked up. I hate you now.
Yeah. Or do you ever have the thing where like you'll be talking about something with someone and you'll be like, well, I think this reality star is garbage. And they're like, well. And they'll give like a slightly variated like version of your opinion. You're like, yep, you're right. Yep, totally, absolutely. Yep, everything I thought for the last like 21 years is wrong. And you are right. And now I've completely unraveled this opinion that I actually kind of liked. And it's a total mind fuck.
Yeah.
And especially with something as trivial as chocolate. Like
exactly. And we do it all the time of like, we think we're supposed to be one way. If you actually just experienced both sides, I mean, obviously there's certain things where that it's not like, I think I never want to have kids. I'm just going to like try out having a baby. Like that's not exactly how it works, but
that
like,
one is not recommended.
Yeah. Please don't. Please don't try that one. I do not want to be held legally responsible for that. But like there's little things. And when you start doing those little things, you start gaining back that control. And I think that takes us back to where we started really of feeling like we're having to do all of these things to, for whatever reason, to maintain whatever we think we're supposed to be maintaining, whether it's that we're drinking or going out or whatever it is. And if you actually just take a step back of what do I genuinely want?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find probably a different story, but you have to actually take that time.
Mm-hmm. Slow down.
Slow the fuck down. That's it. We're so, we love running. That's like how I swear America world works is just like, boom, 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 boom. Yeah. If you slow down, you're going to miss something. But like, it's so cheesy. Slowing down, smell the roses, take a step back, start to acknowledge, I like this. I don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
Even at an older age, I don't think we ask ourselves that enough. And I think your story is a very pertinent one of actually sitting and asking yourself. And that's the real definition of putting yourself first, of redefining and actually saying, what do I like? What do I need?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Thank you.
You're welcome. And so on that note, I think, you know, we covered a lot and we talked about drinking, drinking culture, all that stuff. And I am hoping that kind of in this part two, we can really get into the nitty gritty of what it means to slow down, what it means to ask ourselves these questions, and how they can manifest. And I'm excited to talk more about that.
I know, me too. Me too. It's, you know, I think also when I listened to your podcast and kind of how you were explaining this, I think there's also such an incredible message in these types of conversations that a lot of people feel like they can't have. And to have this space that you are putting out there where you don't necessarily need to engage, but you can just like pop an ear in, is so helpful. And I wish I had this when I had that fateful hangover in October of, what was it, 2021, I guess. But yeah, no, I'm very proud of you. And I know popping up a bed would be too.
Oh, that means so much. Well, I look forward to talking to you again for our part two, and make sure to tune in for our part two so that you can hear more about Sarah's amazing story and hear us go back and forth about our fun but dysfunctional family and how we are learning to kind of, you know, stand up for ourselves, slow down, what that looks like, what that means, and how to actually take that on in a world that is so goddamn fast paced.
Yeah, coming at you from all angles, man.
We got you though. All right. Well, I will talk to you guys later. Thank you.